you like to know where the property hotspots are going to be in 2021 as Australia enters some semblance of normality? Or maybe you'd like to know where property values are going to be at the end of this year. Now, I know that's what a lot of the other podcasts are currently offering you at the moment, so I'm sorry if I'm going to disappoint you, but I'm not going to make any short-term predictions. You only have to look back 12 months and see how all those short-term forecasts worked out. Or even go back a year further, back to the beginning of 2019, and see how incorrect those predictions were as well. On the other hand, it's much easier to tell you where the value of well-located investment-grade properties are going to be in 10 years' time in a decade. But that's not as sexy, is it? The problem is many investors take a short-term approach to real estate, which is really a long-term investment. Then they try and make a quick profit, they try and buy cheaply, or they look for the next hotspot. And again, this is a short-term approach. And then they wonder what to do next. Rather, they should be taking a long-term approach of owning the best assets they can that's going to give them long-term compounding growth and in time produce substantial wealth for them. So in today's show, we continue on the discussion I started last week with Stuart Weems as we work through his 8 fundamental rules for property investment. In other words, we're going to look at the fundamentals, the long-term approach. This is going to serve you much better than learning where the next hotspot is going to be, because as you know, this year's hotspot is going to be next year's hotspot. When you understand these fundamentals, and when you use them to formulate your investment decisions, you're going to be ahead of the game, and you're going to be that small group of investors who builds a multi-million-dollar property portfolio, rather than that large group of investors, 1.9 million Australian investors, who never get past their first or second property. Now, if you haven't heard last week's show yet, please go back and listen to it wherever you're listening to this episode, whichever podcast player you're listening to. But the order in which you listen to them doesn't matter, but just go back to the Michael Yardley podcast. Oh, and by the way, if you don't subscribe while you're there, subscribe to my podcast as well. But there was just too much of information to put in one show, so we split it over two. And today, once you've listened to the two episodes, I believe you're going to be in a much better position to take advantage of the changing property markets that are appearing in front of our eyes in 2021, as you understand Stuart Weems' 8 rules for property investment. So welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialise in helping you grow, protect and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
If you're interested in becoming a successful property investor, you need to understand the rules. You need to understand the game of property investment. Just like Monopoly, you need to know the rules. You need to know when to buy a house, when you buy a hotel or get a Monopoly. And last week, we had a chat with Stuart Weems about his great book, Investopoly, which was a couple of years old, but it's stood the test of time. So today, I want to continue on with the next 4 rules of property investment. If you haven't heard last week's podcast, go back to whichever podcast player you're using and have a listen to the first 4 rules. You don't have to have done that before we continue with today's show, but let's welcome back Stuart Weems. Hello, Stuart.
Hey, Michael. Great to be back here and talking about these rules again. Thank you.
Now, for those of you who don't know, Stuart is an independent financial advisor. He's an author of a number of books, including the one we're going to be discussing today, Investopoly. Also, a great book, The Rules of the Lending Game. He's a regular contributor to the Australian newspaper. He writes for his own great blog and for Property Update. So, Stuart, as we said last week, you wrote this book way back in 2018. Now, that wasn't that many years ago, but a lot has happened in the property markets. We've had our ups and downs in 2019 and again in 2020. So it was an interesting way of testing the rules to see what's going on. Last week, we spoke about the first 4 rules. Play the long game. Real estate investing is a game that takes many years. We spoke about know how much income you need and by when. In other words, begin with the end in mind. Your third golden rule is spend less than you earn and invest the difference regularly. In other words, you've got to build an asset base. And that was actually the 4th rule, building your assets first and then eventually moving to income. Having that as some grounding, let's talk about your golden rule number 5. Set your asset allocation to reduce risk and minimize return. What are you getting at by that?
Well, we had a chat, did a podcast a few weeks ago, Michael, where we talked about investment-grade apartments and how that they've underperformed over the last 8 to 10 years, particularly in Melbourne, and why, and some of the factors, and whether that underperformance will persist and so forth. So obviously people can go back and listen to that podcast. But I'll use that as an example. If what you did 10 years ago is decided I needed to invest in 3 properties, then what you did is go and went and bought all those 3 properties in Melbourne, and they were all investment-grade apartments. In the long run, I'm sure you're going to do fantastically well and the returns are great. In the short run, however, over the last, say, 8 to 10 years, the returns have been very, very poor. And really, if that's all you've done, and that's not like a small amount of investing, of course, you know, when I say that's all you've done, I'm not suggesting that you should have done more, but I'm saying that you've kind of put all your eggs in one basket. Your financial position probably hasn't moved forward unless you've been able to reduce debt, which is obviously contributing additional cash flow. If you haven't been able to make material debt reductions, your financial position hasn't advanced over a 10-year period. However, life goes on, Michael. Some of us have kids and families and school fees and home upgrades and renovations and new cars and holidays and all the sorts of things that we want to, you know, get out of life because we're working and investing hard. But if we put all our eggs in one basket, it's not going to smooth out the return. And why we want to smooth the return out is we want to make it fit. Firstly, we want to make it feel like we're actually taking forward steps to improving our situation. There's nothing more rewarding and satisfying than, say, comparing your net worth to 2 years ago and seeing it advance. Not that I'm saying it's all about money, because obviously life's not all about money, but you need to measure your performance, of course, when investing. And so that's very rewarding. But if it's not doing anything, you're sitting there left, sitting there thinking, oh my God, I've made all these sacrifices. I made these decisions. I paid these buyer's agents. I paid this guy for financial advice, and I'm no better off. That's a deflating situation to be in. So what you want to do is really think carefully about your asset allocation. You want to invest in a way that first, the starting assumption has to be, I don't know what's going to happen in the shorter term, because no one in the world has worked out a reliable way of predicting short-term returns. You know, will Australian shares beat international shares? Will Australian property or Melbourne property beat Sydney property? These sorts of things would, if we knew the answer, it would be incredibly valuable, of course, but we don't know the answer. And it's tempting to try and find the answer or think about it or form a view or, in fact, form a complete investment strategy around the proposition that we know, but the starting assumption has to be we don't know. So therefore, what we want to do is invest in a way, in a combination of assets, asset styles, asset types that are going to diversify our outcomes. So if interest rates go nuts, we need to invest in assets that are going to produce better returns if interest rates go nuts. If interest rates remain low for another 20 years, we also need to invest in assets that are going to do well and benefit from that. That way, no matter what happens, some assets are going to rise, some assets are going to fall, but at a portfolio level, I continue to march on. I get those returns. I feel like I'm making advancements, and that has very important lifestyle consequences too, Michael, because like I say, life goes on and one of the reasons we invest, obviously, to fund retirement, but also to make sure we've got the opportunity to make lifestyle decisions along the way as well.
Well, that goes back to your rule number 1, investing for the long term so that you can ride the cycles, you have the financial buffers in place to see the ups and downs and reduce your risks, because some investment classes are more volatile than others. I think another interesting factor is that if somebody just says to you property, property, property or shares, you should be a little bit careful and run away. You clearly, as a financial advisor, and this isn't financial advice, we're not allowed to give it in this forum, is basically to allocate your funds appropriately. Property is lumpy, so it's not easy to buy a property every 6 months or every 6 years. But let's just talk a bit about the volatility, because volatility scares people. Seeing the value of your share portfolio go down as it did in the beginning of 2020 overnight when COVID came out scares people. And it's easy to say be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. It's easy to say I've got a long-term view and I'm not going to sell, but it's hard to control those emotions, isn't it?
It is. And so I think at the outset, we just need to prepare ourselves. And we need to be realistic about what the returns are going to be. We can be realistic about what long-term returns are. And I think that the further you think out, ironically, the more predictable returns are. You know, over a 30-year period, I can be relatively confident to say that investment-grade property will produce capital growth of somewhere between 6 to 8% plus inflation over the long run. I don't think that's really sticking my neck out. What it will do this year and next, I mean, I can take a stab, but that's all it is a stab, a guess. But that's the problem, is that if I start thinking, oh, well, 10% returns, that's kind of what I fall in love with and that's what I expect. But the point is you can't expect that every year. So different assets are going to have different volatility rates. Just generally, a share's around about 20%. Property, Australian property, is around about 10%, so half the volatility rate.
Just to explain, Stuart, volatility, you and I understand, but there may be somebody listening to this who doesn't fully know what you mean by that. So let's just explain what that is. Shares can drop in value much quicker. The volatility is the difference in what share prices can do from top to bottom of a range.
So if we assume that property and shares can produce a long-term return of 10%, which is actually very close to what the long-term 30, 40-year data suggests. If the property volatility rate is 10%, it means your return can be plus or minus 10%. So it can really range between 0 and 20%. Whereas if shares, as we know, long-term returns are 10%, but volatility is 20%, it means our returns can be a loss of 10% to a positive of 30%, a much, much larger range. And it's the loss part that's the concerning bit. And remember, volatility is kind of averaged out over time. So we might get periods where shares will give us a negative 40% return in any one particular year. But we can get years where it gives us a positive 40% return as well. So if we can invest in an asset, close our eyes, cross our fingers, and then wake up in 10 years and look at the value, then you don't really care about volatility. Volatility doesn't matter. It's just about quality and returns. But the reality is that most of us aren't going to do that. And some people, for example, even their super, they'll log in and they'll watch it every single day and they'll ride that emotional roller coaster. But you need to invest in assets that are commensurate with your risk. And volatility, to some degree, is a good measure of risk. If I don't have a big risk appetite, if I don't like log in and see my balance drop and then rise, and I don't like to ride that roller coaster, then I want to invest in lower volatility assets. It's that simple.
So as a professional advisor, I assume you look at people's goals, their risk profile, their time until retirement, where they're starting from, where they want to end up going, and then you put a plan together. And that's really important. So property investment, or investment in general, has to be strategically, holistically approached. And I think that both your firm and ours look at the holistic approach. It's not just one asset class, and you have the advice of you having the tax background, the financial planning background, the mortgage background can give that holistic advice. It's too hard to build a good asset base just with one field. In today's environment in particular, you need more than just a buyer's agent, or in my mind, more than just a property strategist. We're working through the rules of investing from Investopoly. And I just want to say that in your book, I remember you actually back-tested various allocations. In other words, you saw how it would work out. So if people want to get your book, Investopoly, if they go to the Pro Solutions website, how do they find the book? Where is it going to be?
Yeah, if you just Google Investopoly and Pro Solution, for example, that page will come up. There's a menu item on our website called Books, and pretty obvious. And you can go there. You can use the code Yardney to get a discount. and we'll send it to you for $20 and we'll pay for the postage. I was just going to say, Michael, in terms of risk profiling, it's a really interesting one. I actually don't think people have that different risk profiles. I think I could probably put people into two cohorts, people that are very conservative. That is, they're not really that worried about investment returns. They're just worried about retention of capital, and then the rest. And the rest of us, we like returns, but we don't like losing money. It's that simple. We want to make an investment. We're happy to make a long-term investment. We realize we might not get a return each and every year, but don't lose my money. It's that, you know, some people will say, oh, no, I've got a really strong risk appetite. I'm happy to write. No, they're not. When they lose 40%, there's not a smile on their face. No one's happy about it. So I think people, so what I should say, you know, what can people learn from that is be realistic. Be realistic about what your appetite is. You know, if you go to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week, save hard, invest hard, you don't want to lose that money. It's very, very simple. And so don't take high risks. Don't do stupid things with your money. And that's the point. Adopting evidence-based strategies, which I know we're going to talk about in the next couple of rules, is kind of fundamental to that.
So interestingly, the risk isn't always with the asset class, with the shares, with the property. The risk is with the investor, who sometimes doesn't understand that they're the biggest risk, but that's part of our education process to help you understand these things. Golden rule number 6 isn't about property, and while this show is about property in general, it's really more about making money and success. So your golden rule number 6 from your book, Investopoly, was invest in the share market using low-cost passive investments.
Yep. So there's two types of ways to invest in shares. I mean, there's many types of ways, but we can really categorize into two types of methodologies or approaches. The first one is called active funds management, which can be either picking a fund manager, an active fund manager, someone that says, give me your money and we'll decide which stocks to buy, and we'll hold maybe 30 different stocks in the Aussie market and we'll pick which ones are going to grow faster or which ones are undervalued. There's a few different sort of approaches that they can utilize, and we'll charge you 1% a year, and we'll try and do that. And certainly the banks, MLC, AMP, these sorts of guys, they're the sorts of players in that active funds management space. And that although fees have been coming down, you're typically going to pay 0.8 to 1% a year of your investment balance for them to run that fund. And there might be some additional costs, performance fees and transactional costs, but they're less material. It's really, let's just call it 1%. Also in that active management space is direct share picking. So that, and that could be going to a stockbroker or you subscribing to a newsletter, and you might pick some stocks. You know, let's buy CSL or BHP or the banks or Telstra or whatever it might be. And you pick a handful of stocks, thinking that you can spot the ones that are undervalued, that the market has got it wrong, because that's really what you're doing, is you're betting against the market, that the market is wrong, the price is wrong, the value is much more or much less than what the market's trading at. And you need to do that consistently well in order to generate quality returns. So that's active management. The second methodology is what's called passive management. It's a rules-based approach that tends to be very low cost and very diversified. And a very basic version, there's a few different rules-based index-style approaches that are really fantastic approaches. But to use a very simplistic example of market capitalization indexing, which is like saying, I'll go and buy an ASX 200 index fund. And what that index fund does is it holds the top 200 stocks in Australia, and it holds them according to their market capitalization, so their company value. So, for example, CSL might make up 8% of the index, so 8% of your money would go into CSL. And CBA might make up 7% of the index, so 7% would go into CBA, and so on and so forth. And that might rebalance typically every 6 to 12 months. And that's index investing. Those index funds can cost as little as 0.05%, so 20 times less than active funds management, and they're far more diversified. Now, here's the stats. There's lots of longitudinal studies, a lot in the US market because it's a much wider and deeper market, but also there's plenty in the Aussie market. But over the long run, 5-10 years, approximately 80% of active fund managers fail to beat the index. So the index, anyone can get access to. We don't need to be smart. We just need to buy that index, right? We need to know nothing about shares. So that's got to be your starting point. 80% of professionals out there that are doing it day in, day out, fail to beat the market. And the worst thing is that when they do beat the market, the persistence of outperformance just isn't there. So if you pick the top fund manager this year, there's only about a 15% chance they're going to be the top fund manager next year, and about a 2% chance they'll be the top fund manager the year after. So if you are going to roll the dice and trying to do active funds management, then you've got to pick which fund manager is going to win this year. Then you've got to sell them at the end of the year and try and pick the winner next year. And you've got to do that consistently well to offset the higher fees and produce better returns. It's a nonsense, right? I mean, anyone, once explained, people are going to go, well, why would I take the risk? That's insane. Why would you do that when you can pay substantially lower fees and use a methodology that is proven, mathematically proven, to generate better longer-term returns? Sometimes up to 96% of active, so index funds will be active fund managers over periods of time. So the stats aren't line ball. They're absolutely compelling. And finally, Michael, then if you say, okay, well, that's what the professional market is doing, then can you imagine what individuals are doing that are picking their own shares and how they're performing? And the kicker is, because I've been doing this for nearly 20 years, the kicker is, Michael, when I ask people that have been managing their own share portfolio, okay, what have the returns been like? Show me the returns. Oh, don't know. Haven't calculated them. And a lot of people that use stockbrokers that are expensive, same thing, same question. Oh, show me the returns. Oh, the stockbroker doesn't calculate returns. Oh, don't they? Of course not. It creates accountability and a bit of transparency, which it's completely unnecessary if you're a stockbroker or share picker. So it's really about adopting an evidence-based approach, Michael, and that's what I believe is the right approach when investing. Let's not throw darts at dartboards. Let's invest in a way where there's overwhelming evidence that if we had have invested this way over the last 30 years, that the returns would have been good quality, what we would expect.
I know some people are doing it because they enjoy the investing. They enjoy the charts, the graphs. They enjoy trying to pick the next stock hotspot or the next property hotspot. The trouble is, investing isn't meant to be fun. Investing is meant to be boring, to give you the wherewithal to make the rest of your life fun. So, Stuart, if people ask me about that, whether it's in stocks or in property, I say, go bungee jumping, go trail bike riding. That's fun. That's exciting. Don't get your kicks out of investing, whether it's the stock market or the property market, which leads to golden rule number 7, only invest in investment-grade properties. And I think let's make it clear, not every property is investment-grade. Any property can be an investment. You kick out the owner, the landlord, and you put a tenant in, and all of a sudden it's an investment. We both talk about that a bit, investment-grade properties. How do you define an investment-grade property, Stuart?
I think the methodology, the evidence-based methodology we use with investing in property is almost the reverse of the investing in shares. In shares, as I just explained, the stats show that we can't pick the winning stock, that even the professionals can't do it. It's not possible. So instead of trying to pick the needle in the haystack, invest in the haystack, which is the index fund, right? But that same method, if we apply the same methodology to property, then what we would be saying is that we can't pick a good property. So let's just go and invest in every property in Toorak in Melbourne, for example, because we know Toorak's a great suburb. There's a lot of really valuable real estate there. So let's just invest in everything. Let's buy every single property in Toorak. But of course, we know that, you know, that property on a really busy main road is an impaired location. We wouldn't want to own that property. Okay, so we do then know that there's some properties we don't want to buy. So therefore, what I suggest is just looking at investment grade property. And there's three fundamental factors or characteristics that an investment grade asset will possess, and it must possess all three. The first one is it must have a strong land value component. Obviously, we all know land appreciates, building depreciate. So we want to have more of our money in the appreciating part, the land part, and less of our money in the building part. In fact, I would argue that the only reason we have a dwelling on the land, a building, is to earn $1 of income, because that $1 of income will then make the interest tax deductible and it would be more tax effective. But if I could have my way, I would much prefer every single dollar of return, except for one, in capital growth. I want less income and more growth because of that compounding nature of growth. So it has to have a strong land value component. Houses are better for that reason. You can tend to maybe get 70, 80% land value, although, Michael, you'll be able to speak much more intelligently about this than I can. But certainly with older style apartments, it's more than 50%. And that's why they work. So that's the first thing, more than 50% land value. The second thing is it has to have scarcity. Scarcity in terms of location, and then scarcity in terms of architectural style or building style or building type. So location, there just can't be any available land around the location that you're looking at investing in. So no vacant land, that rules out sort of new build or new development areas, because what we're trying to do is find areas that are in finite supply that have excessive demand. If you hold supply the same, but our population growth continues to grow, demand continues to increase, there's an imbalance, and that creates price appreciation. So scarcity in terms of land supply, and then scarcity in terms of dwelling style as well. So if we think about high-rise apartments, you know, there might be 300 in the building. There's no scarcity there. But if we compare that to, say, an Art Deco block of eight, no one's building double brick Art Deco blocks of apartments anymore, Michael. So that is a very scarce asset. Now, we might not like that architectural style, Art Deco. It's grown on me over the years. I quite like it now. But 20 years ago, I really didn't. I thought it was ugly. Who cares whether we like it, though? All we need to fall in love with is the capital growth. But again, that scarcity, same with Victorian cottages. No one's building them anymore. In fact, sometimes they're pulling them down if they're allowed to. So really, supply is reducing. It's not even fixed. It's reducing. And that creates that, again, that supply-demand pressure. And the last factor, that's that scarcity, and then the last factor is proven performance. Why would I invest in an asset if it hasn't demonstrated its ability to give me good quality capital growth, a good level of capital growth? Why would I take the risk? Because I can compare two assets, one that's brand new, who knows how it's going to go, and one that's been around for 30, 40, 50, 100 years, and I can't trace the capital growth back 100 years, and to some degree that's meaningless. But I can look back over the last three or four decades and imply or impute a capital growth rate based on a number of different sales over that period, and it builds a picture. And I can look at what next door has grown to, if it's a comparable property, and down the street and around the corner, and it builds a story. And if the story is these properties have generated 12% in capital growth since 1980, well, I'm not going to sit here and say you should expect 12% over the next 20 years or 12% each year. But what you do know is the capital growth is going to be good. And relative to the market, because that's what we really need to measure is relative performance. Relative to the market, it's going to be good. So strong land value component, there's got to be a scarcity element in terms of location and type of dwelling. And the last one is proven performance. And if a property has all those three characteristics, Michael, to my mind, it's investment grade.
And of course, the reason we're wanting investment grade properties is because they outperform with regard to capital growth and rental return. Once a quarter, CoreLogic came up with their pain and gain report, and one sees that a lot of properties, when sold, are sold at a loss. In general, they tend to be the apartments, the inner city apartments. But again, when we sit down with clients and do portfolio reviews, we can see how their properties have performed. And often properties that they've bought before that become clients of Metropole, and investment grade ones we've bought for them, perform very differently. And in the first year or two, 1 or 2% difference doesn't seem to mean a lot, does it, Stuart? But over a period of time, the gap between the capital growth of investment grade property and the average property just gets wider and wider. And that allows them to borrow against the increasing equity to buy another property or have the cash flow support either their portfolio or their lifestyle. So if you're wanting to build an asset base, it's just too hard to do unless you're getting that capital growth and the rental growth.
That's right, and that's why golden rule number one, Michael, was play the long game, as we discussed in the last episode, which is really take that long-term approach and understand a small difference in capital growth rate makes a massive difference. So if then I've got to pay a buyer's agent 20 grand to get the right property, might in the short run, if I focus only on the next year, that's a big expense. If I focus on a 20-year outcome, that's immaterial and a very good and wise thing to do. The other thing too is that's the benefit of having principles and rules is that you can reflect on them and you can run the ruler over past investment decisions. So for people listening to this that have had a really positive experience investing in property, they can apply those three rules, land value, scarcity, and proven performance. And then they can understand then with that asset, and I'm almost going to bet that asset's had all three of those things and that's why it's performed well. But by the same token, if someone's got an asset, a property that they're not particularly happy with, think about those three things and it probably almost certainly is because it lacks one of those things. You know, it doesn't have that scarcity because it's too close to land supply or there's too much building value and there was no proven performance. You know, if it's lacking all three, you're in trouble.
The problem is we all have a debt cap. There's only so much the banks are going to allow us to borrow. It's a bit different from years gone by, which means if you can only buy two or three properties or whether it's five or seven properties, you really have to own the best properties. You can't have underperforming properties in your portfolio. And I remember last year in one of our podcasts, you used a beautiful example. You don't just want that diamond. You were saying you want that pink diamond. That's the only sort of property you should buy. So it's important to be very selective.
The quality of your assets, whether that's shares, property or whatever, the quality of your assets will determine your outcomes. It's that simple. It's very logical. So if you want quality outcomes, if you want quality returns in the long run, you must adopt quality methodologies and invest in quality assets. You can't turn, you know, something that's not great into gold. It's just not going to happen.
Well, you can't expect investment grade returns from a non-investment grade asset. It's unrealistic. It's silly. Now, we're working through the 8 golden rules of investment from Stuart Williams' book, Investopoly. And the last one, Stuart, is protect your investments from expected and unexpected risks.
I guess the, you know, as the saying goes, Michael, plan for the worst, hope for the best. I'm an optimist by nature, so I don't necessarily like to think about, you know, plan for the worst. But the reality that is that that's what we need to do. And there's really just a couple of fundamental things that most people need to think about. Of course, there's other things like asset protection and these sorts of things. And if, you know, statistically, marital relationship separations are risks as well, these sorts of things. But really, I can solidify it into probably two things that people really need to think about. The first one is insurance. Most importantly, income protection insurance. Because let's use the starting assumption we're going to actually not die tomorrow. I think that's a pretty negative assumption if we just assume we're going to die tomorrow. So life and TPD, total and permanent disability insurance, they are important and I'm not diminishing their value. But I think from an investor perspective, particularly a property investor, one of the starting assumptions and key assumptions is I have an income stream that I can borrow against and that's going to allow me to borrow some money to go and buy an asset. Now, if I can't get out of bed and go to work for the next 7-10 years, and that's what we're really worried about is long-term incapacity. We're not really worried about breaking our leg and not being able to work for a couple of months. We're really worried about the car accident and I'm out of work for 10 years. That is going to be a disaster to my investment strategy. So if I'm prepared to go out and borrow, then the way I look at it is a cost of borrowing, a cost of investment cost is insuring my income. That's just prudent, I think, in my view. Of course, it depends on the quantum of the premium and so forth. You need to see some value for money in that regard. But ensuring your income stream, that is your most valuable asset. Until you build your asset base, that is your most valuable asset and you need to be insuring it. So to some degree, it's sort of planning for the worst. It's planning for an event that's going to render you incapacitated for a long period of time, several years, and you need to sort of guard against that. And particularly if you're in your 30s and 40s, income protection insurance isn't that expensive if you're thinking about you're insuring the next 30, 40 years worth of income. And the second one, which is really kind of to some degree the starting assumption is that you might die tomorrow, is putting a will together. It's I would say 80 to 90% of new prospective clients that I meet either don't have a will or it's substantially out of date. And it seems like one of those things that is complex. We don't know where to start. Maybe it's costly and, you know, I'll get to it. We know it's important, but we certainly hope it's not urgent. And that's fine. But, you know, not having a will, particularly if you're building wealth for dependents such as children or a spouse or something like that, you want to make sure that you've got the right structures in place and your assets are protected and they're going to go to the people that you, in a way that you would expect and hope. And it really is not a big deal. I mean, putting a will together doesn't take a lot of time. It's not that costly and it's relatively simple to do, but we just need to get it done. And they're the two things I think where most people fail in terms of managing their risk and protecting their overall portfolio.
There's an even bigger picture form of risk management. That's the correct ownership structures, which I know you as an accountant understand well, and the correct finance structures, having a buffer in place. During last year, when the property market had its ups and downs, I don't think there was one of our clients, Stuart, who ended up having to go into either the financial distress or sell their property because we'd set them up with financial buffers to see them through. We have no idea what unexpected X factor is going to happen, but every year something goes wrong and things go right as well. So it's nice to protect yourself that way as well.
Yeah, spot on. You know, the right structures, if a tenant sues you, what happens there? If you have business problems, what happens there? You need to protect against those things, and that's very important to do as well. And buffers, yeah, you're right. We saw last year that they're incredibly important, having some cash in the bank or ready access to credit. We know that property is an illiquid asset, so we don't want to be in a situation where we're forced to sell it, say, within a year. But if we need to make a decision, we need to sell this property, say, in the next 5 years, then we can be more strategic about it and kind of pick the market that's going to best suit that property to sell in. And the only way we're going to give ourselves really 5 years of runway to make that decision is to make sure we've got the right buffers in place. And it gives us that sleep at night factor, Michael. We know that, look, if I've got access to 5 years worth of living expenses, even though it's debt, like even though, you know, you don't necessarily want to fund living expenses from debt, but, you know, if worst comes to worst, you don't need to sell anything. You're not going to be a forced seller in a market that doesn't suit selling. It gives you that sleep at night factor.
That's really why you need to see a finance strategist when you set yourself up to get into the property market. I don't think I've ever heard of a bank manager or the guy across the teller or the counter at the bank advise their clients about having buffers in place. Because as we've said, and as you've written in your more recent book, the Rules of Lending, that property investment's a game of finance with some houses thrown in the middle. So there's another great book that you've written, not just Investopoly, but The Rules of the Lending Game. And if people want to get those books, I know you're offering a discount to them if they use my name Yardley in the coupon code there. So either look up Investopoly or The Rules of the Lending Game by Stuart Weems. Stuart, we've worked through your 8 golden rules. And congratulations, they are rules, they are fundamentals, they are pillars because they have stood the test of time. Number one, play the long game. Number two, know how much income you need. Begin with the end in mind. Number three, spend less than you earn and invest the difference regularly. Rule number four was invest for assets, grow your asset base first before you start moving to cash flow. Your fifth rule was set your asset allocation to reduce risk, maximize returns. Understand about volatility. Rule number six, invest in the share market as well as the property market, but understand that index funds are probably going to well outperform, in the long term, definitely outperform the more expensive fund managers or stockbrokers that you may think about. Rule number 7, only invest in investment-grade properties. And the last one is, you've worked so hard at putting it all together, protect your investments through insurance and proper planning. Stuart, that was a great two sessions we've just recorded. Thank you very much. I look forward to catching up with you again real soon for our more regular chats.
I look forward to catching up and doing this podcast maybe in 10 years' time and again, Michael, and reflecting back on the rules to make sure that they've stood the test of time. I'm sure they will. And hopefully it gives people a foundation and a framework for making financial decisions. And I certainly promise if you follow the rules, your chance of being a successful investor is, and I don't say this with any level of arrogance, is probably increased by a factor of 10. In fact, if you follow the rules, you're not going to make a mistake. And I'd say it that simply. So it's been great, and thanks for the invitation.
Well, I guess the first rule summarizes it all. Also, invest for the long term. Understand the long term rules. Don't invest for the latest hotspot. As we're moving into a new year and a new cycle, I bet there's going to be a whole lot of new gurus, many of them with well intentioned meaning, but they're enthusiastic amateurs coming up with new ways, new tricks, new ways of getting around things. No, don't look for the latest fad. Stick to what's always worked rather than what's working this year. Thanks for your time, Stuart.
Thanks, Michael.
In a moment, I'm going to share my mindset message with you. But before I do, I just want to follow on the conversation I just had with Stuart Weems and remind you that our property markets are changing, they're turning, and there's a great window of opportunity for people who want to get involved in real estate investment or buying their next home. But I don't mean you're going to find a cheap property. There's no bargains. Well, there aren't any in the good investment grade locations or for A-grade homes. But when you look back in a year or two, you're probably going to think, gee, that was pretty cheap when I bought it then. But I also want to remind you that not all properties are going to increase in value as our market moves forward. So you've got to be careful, and correct asset selection is critical, even if it is for your own home. So be careful who you listen to, because there's lots of advisors out there at the moment who get paid to help you buy a property. They don't get paid to tell you to hold on to your current assets and wait until you've got the right amount of money. They don't get paid to tell you to sell a property, which may be the right answer for you. So I believe moving forward today, you're going to need direction. You're going to need guidance. To get wealth-producing results, you're going to need more than a buyer's agent. They're part of the plan, but they fulfill the order put together by a property strategist. But you need more than a property strategist. You need a holistic approach to get through what we're going to have interesting times in 2021. And that's what my team at Metropole help you with. Why don't you go to metropole.com.au and you'll see that we provide strategic property advice by starting off by building you a strategic property plan, a customized plan. Planning is bringing your future into the present so you can do something about it now. This is going to give you the direction you want, the results and the certainty. It's also going to give you safety because it's going to stop you making the mistakes. Then, sure, we'd be happy for you to use our buyer's agency, our wealth advisory, our financial planning, property management, renovations, development. I don't know about you. I don't know which services you need or property management, but go to metropole.com.au and why not find out about our range of services, organise a time to catch up with one of my team. I'd love to be part of your wealth creation journey, because 2021 is going to be a great year for those who know how to take advantage of it.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In today's mindset message, I'd like to explain to you that how you see the world has a significant effect on your success. I've learned that broadly there are two ways of seeing the world, and they have a great influence on how successful you become. The first is what psychologists call an external locus of control, and the second is the internal locus of control. You see, as the world around you changes, you can either attribute your success or failures to things you've got control over, or to forces outside your influence. And which orientation you choose, that's going to have a great bearing on your long-term success. Now, this concept dates back to the 1960s when Julian Rotter's investigation of how people's behaviours and attitudes affected the outcomes of their lives brought about this concept. Locus of control describes what individuals perceive, what they think about the underlying causes of their events in their lives. Look, put more simply, are you the pilot of your life? Or are you just a passenger going along for a ride? Do you believe your destiny is controlled by you or by external forces such as fate or your boss or the government or the system or other things? Now, researchers have found that people with an internal locus of control, they tend to praise or blame themselves for the successes or failures. They don't assign responsibility to things outside their influence. A student with a strong internal locus of control, for instance, they're going to attribute their good marks to their hard work rather than to being naturally smart. A salesman with an internal locus of control is going to blame a lost sale on their lack of hustle rather than bad fortune. Internal locus of control can be linked to academic success, higher self-motivation, social maturity, lower incidence of stress and depression, and a longer life. Well, that's what psychologists said, and I agree with them. I found that people with an internal locus of control tend to earn more money, have more friends, stay married longer, and report greater professional success and satisfaction. What's an external locus of control then, if people with an internal locus of control do better? Well, we all know those people with an external locus of control. In fact, sometimes we are those people. Nothing is their fault. There's always an excuse. The world is out to get them. Life's unfair. Having an external locus of control, believing that your life's primarily influenced by events outside your control, that's been correlated to higher levels of stress. Often individuals perceive the situations just beyond them, beyond their coping, beyond their capabilities. Now, I guess what I'm trying to point out to you is the benefits of having an internal locus of control. As I said, in general, people with an internal locus of control, those who believe they're responsible for all their actions, they engage in activities that are going to improve their situation. They emphasize striving for achievement. They work hard to develop their knowledge, their skills and their abilities because they know when they do, life's going to be better. They're inquisitive. They try and find out things, why things turned out the way they did. They take note of information that they can use to create positive outcomes in the future. They've got more participative management styles. So the bottom line is, you weren't born with an unalterable locus of control. So it's critical for you to keep an eye on yourself and see how you can improve, see how you can get on further in this world. Sure, bad things happen to us, but rather than dwelling on them, it's better to find a useful belief about them and move on. It's important to remove the idea that your life is dictated by forces outside of you, outside of your control. Look, of course, to one degree or another, it is. But there's plenty that we can control. And you can create your own luck through study, through hard work, through perseverance. It's often said that you're a blend of the five people you hang around the most. This is important to keep in mind. Associate with positive people who believe they're in control of their own lives as well, because their beliefs, their energy is going to rub off on you. And then yours will rub off on them. It becomes a powerful and positive feedback loop. So, as I said, the way you see the world will have a huge significance on your success. It's important for you to realize you're the pilot of your life, not just a passenger going along for the ride. As I said at the beginning of this show, this is the second of a two-part series with Stuart Weems, and if you haven't heard the first part, go back to whichever podcast app you're listening to. It was the last show where you can hear the first episode of this two-part series. By the way, if you don't already subscribe to this podcast, why not do that? Because twice a week, I'm going to be bringing you my own thoughts, as well as that of a number of expert guests, just like I did today. By the way, if you want to catch up with me in between these shows, you can follow me on social media. Just look for Michael Yardney or subscribe to my Property Update daily blog. In the meantime, if you'd like to help others become more financially fluent, just like I'm trying to help you, why not tell somebody about the Michael Yardney podcast or leave us a review? And I'll be back with you again real soon. Have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?